Hi, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Tuesday, April the 9th. We'll be joined in a minute here by our good friend, George Rodriguez from South Texas. We're going to talk a little Texas. How are you, George?
Real good. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. I just wanted to begin today. This is a historic day in American history, April the 9th, 1865. This was the day that Lee surrendered to Grant.
Oh, yeah.
Thus formally ending the Civil War. And anyway, just one of those moments, you know, that really stands out. Obviously, there's no video or film of that moment. There are some photos. But there have been some recreations in movies. And I, you know, some of the recreations are really good in movies that they've made of this moment. And my favorite one, at least from the movies, and I think it's true, it actually did happen, is that when Lee is walking or, you know, gets on his horse and they go away, that all the soldiers salute each other on both sides.
Right.
Indicating, I guess, the respect that they had for each other. So April the 9th, 1865, one only wonders if Lee had not surrendered that day, how much longer this could have gone, because there were some elements of the Confederates that wanted to keep on fighting. So,
oh yeah, there definitely wanted to be a guerrilla warfare that would continue. And you know, I've been to Appomattox, and I think the thing that struck me the most was how it ended in a very peaceful and amicable manner. It with so much respect and so much dignity. Something that is just not, you know, it's not heard of,
right,
in normal circumstances. This was, there was an effort by both Grant and other Union generals to literally embrace the Confederates in a brother-like manner, and that's the thing that really struck me. It was really, yeah, it was really something beautiful.
Well, I think Grant and Lee were both students at the military academy, at the U.S. Army Military Academy, whose name
at West Point, yeah.
West Point, yeah, West Point. So, I mean, yes, it was a look. Every civil war is terrible. I mean, civil wars are the worst kinds of wars.
Most civil wars do not end the way that ours did.
No, I agree. I agree with that.
I mean, all you have to do is just look at the Russian Civil War, at the Spanish Civil War, that have been recent ones, and they end in every way but.
Right. I agree. Embrace
each other.
I agree with you. Anyway, just one of those moments in history, April 9th, 1865. You know, one more thing I'll say about that. 1865 is 158 years.
Yep.
159 years. And yet, you know, that is a moment people don't forget. 159 years is a long time. But this was such a defining moment in the history of the country that we don't, you know, we keep on remembering it, which speaks volumes of how important that day was. Well, let's talk a little bit about some current events. George, let's begin with SB4. Still tied up in the courts. I guess one can speculate all we want. My sense is that the longer, and this is just a gut feeling, but the longer that this drags out, what it says to me is the more difficult for, the federal government, the more difficult it's getting for them to kill this. I mean, if the federal government's argument had been really crisp and sharp, this would have gone down a week ago. So the fact that it keeps on going on, the fact that they're still talking about it, says to me, at least to me, and it's just an opinion, that the argument to support SB4 is hanging in there, George.
Yeah, I agree. I think that from day one that we've been speaking about this, or that anybody has been speaking about this, the situation has been that, number one, the federal government is failing to protect the state of Texas. And that state of Texas passed this law to protect its citizens the best it could in the absence of the federal government protecting the border. And it's going to really come down to the failure of the federal government doing its job and what role a state has in doing in protecting its citizens. That's the bottom line in this whole thing. And it's, you know, how it's explained, how it's it is ruled, that's going to be the dicey one, because it has the power, it has the potential to create a situation where, again, like in the Civil War, a state can step up and do what the federal government is not doing. You know, whereas in the Civil War it was a battle over maintaining the state's rights. In this one, it's one to maintain national rights or national protection of the state.
Right.
And it's going to be very, very interesting how it is written. It is going to be very, very interesting how it is written. And the Biden administration, those that feel that the national government is supreme, are going to lose tremendously in this. And I think that this is, I'm just holding my breath on how it's going to be written.
Yeah. Well, my again, I think you're right. I mean, Texas is not creating any, Texas is not going around.
Exactly.
Texas is saying we're going to enforce federal laws passed by Congress. So it's how do you deny a state from doing that?
Exactly.
I mean, Texas is not rewriting anything.
It is the failure of the federal government.
Exactly. And Texas is saying, look, it is illegal to come into the country without papers, and we're just enforcing that. So that's why I think this is dragging, because Texas has a very strong case. And the fact that it's still hanging in there says to me that the federal government is trying to win its case, but it doesn't sound to me like they're winning over the justices or the judges, because they would have, if they had a very strong case, as was the case with Arizona years ago, 10 years ago, whatever it was, that went down fairly quickly. This one seems to be dragging on. Now, if Texas loses here, then it goes to the Supreme Court. And then I guess if the Supreme Court takes it, we could be looking at June or July before an opinion comes out, George.
Yeah, it is, you know, again, how a state reacts in maintaining its constitutional rights of protecting its citizens. You know, I was on Jorge Ramos not too long ago, and I had to explain to him, you know, the name of the country is the United States for a reason. We are citizens of the state primarily, and the states are part of a national fabric, of a national government. Therefore, it is the federal government has a national right to or responsibility, should I say, to protect the citizens of the state. Now, if they're failing to do that, then the state's got to do something. Bottom line, I mean, it's that logical.
George, the other thing, too, that I'm guessing, and this is just a guess of my part, but the judges who are sitting in front of this case, who are looking at this case, they watch on TV what everybody else watches.
Oh, gosh, yes. I mean, so, this whole situation in El Paso recently.
Yes. So wow. I mean, when they hear that there's chaos on the border, they don't have to take their word for it.
No.
All they have to do is watch the daily news. And so, I mean, this is like confirmation that there's chaos on
the liberals have shot themselves in the foot.
Yes.
The liberals have shot themselves in the foot. They, instead of changing the government the right way with the voters, with the states, they have wanted to do it in a roundabout fashion. You know, in a Marxist way that I call it a Marxist way, where they push their will as best they can in roundabout manners, and it's failing. And now they are they're looking at the backlash. Now they're looking at a situation where it's coming back to haunt them. And I'm not sure how, you know, I just don't think that they know how to react on this matter.
No, I think so. And I think, again, these judges are torn because they see, you know, they can read the Constitution, you know, that they know that traditionally the border has been a federal prerogative, but they're looking at the news themselves every night. And they, it doesn't take a lot to persuade someone
right.
that the federal government is failing. Again, just look at the border. Look at what's happening in Arizona. Look what's happening in California, where they're being flooded now because the word
all of a sudden they're all upset because illegals are coming in there.
Yeah, but the word has gone out. You know, the word has gone out that coming into Texas is not a good idea. So now they're going the other way, and that's creating tremendous problems over there. So we'll keep an eye on it. But I don't know how it's going to go down, but I wouldn't be surprised if Texas wins because I think they have a very good case here. Now, speaking of someone who has not been very responsible or done his job, Secretary Mayorkas, as you know, was impeached. And the Senate apparently has finally decided to do what they're supposed to do, which is to hold a trial. And that's going to be a nightmare for the White House. Because once again, all this information is going to be in the news. And how does Mayorkas defend the border? I mean, that's a loser for this administration. So, you know what? It might be the best thing for Mayorkas might be to resign.
Yes.
And not put the country through this trial, because this trial is not going to be good for him, not going to be good for the administration. Now, he's going to survive it because they need 67 votes and they don't have them.
They don't have 67 votes.
But my goodness, just the exposure of this information.
It's going to be it's going to be terrible PR. For the Biden administration, terrible PR. And, you know, they need to acknowledge that rather than to try to find people who will play the victim card. And yeah. Because for every person that's going to say, well, I'm just trying to make a good, I'm just trying to fill the American dream. You're going to find folks who are victims of illegal immigration crime. You're going to find folks who are victims because their property has been damaged. You're gonna find all sorts of folks who will turn around and say that the Biden administration has not controlled the border.
Right. And to me, George, it comes down, and I've been saying this every time I have an opportunity to go on Spanish TV, I always come back to the same thing, and that is that immigration has to be orderly. There has to be a process. That is, people have to come in the right way. There is a process to come in. Now, yes, there is asylum, and there are special cases of asylum. But giving people a little piece of paper that says 8 million of you are going to look for a judge and wait for you, that's not asylum.
That's not asylum.
That's not asylum. That is very bad.
You can come in first, and then we'll determine if you're allowed to stay.
Right. And you know... And many people say, well, the Cubans, well, it's a little different with the Cubans because the Cubans were identified as people who were coming from a communist country, but still there was an orderly process to come in. I mean, we didn't have 8 million people show up on the shores. I mean, the fact is that for a long, long time, they were coming in on daily flights and they were processed in Miami, but that's because the Cubans were targeted as a group and granted special immigration consideration. What we are doing on the border is targeting everybody as a group, and anybody in the world who shows up on the border and says, I've got a beef with my government, I want to see a judge about asylum, they're given a piece of paper that says, okay, you can see a judge in 6 years. That's insane, George. It's absolutely insane.
Yeah, there is no determined matter of screening people carefully so that you know who really should be eligible to apply for this. Everybody is being allowed to apply for it. And then on top of that, everybody's being allowed to come in and wait for a judge. And then the vast majority of them are not showing up for a judge.
Right.
We know they're not going to do that. So
that's another problem.
All we're doing is just letting them in.
Right. And so that just doesn't make any sense at all. And then we're letting them in. The way we're letting them in, they cannot work legally because they don't have a work visa because they have not been approved by a judge. I mean, how in the world are you going to give a work visa to someone here who's waiting to see a judge? And then on the other hand, you've got people legally waiting to enter the country. And I mean, how do you do that? You can't do that. So, you know, you've got these people coming in. They have no legal ability to work. Most of them are working where whatever they can do, probably under the table, most of them. I mean, it's just absolutely chaos. I mean, I actually feel sorry for some of these people because I think they were misled by the Biden administration to come to the border.
Oh, completely.
And then they had to pay to come to the border. I mean, completely. I feel terrible for them.
If anybody has been victimized, it is these people, these migrants, so-called migrants that have been encouraged by the Biden administration to come in. And all it is that they have been political pawns in somebody's ideological plan to fundamentally change America. That's what it comes down to.
Yeah. Well, whatever plan it was, I mean, the idea that you could bring 8 to 10 million people into a country in a disorderly way and hope that this was not going to be chaotic. I mean, I don't know what they were smoking in the White House when they came up with this one.
Well,
you know. Because this is crazy. I mean, this is just absolutely crazy. And look at now you've got the mayor of Chicago saying that he needs 400,000 job permits. Well, yeah. Good luck with that. Good luck with that. Really good luck with that.
What's really interesting with all of that is that you still have these far leftist mayors that continue to want and demand more money, more job permits, more everything except closing the border, controlling the border. None of them say anything about that.
Well, that again, I mean, that shows you how influential this crazy left wing, open borders crazy left wing is over the Democrat Party, because you would think that if anybody understands the insanity of what President Biden is doing on the border, it would be these Democrat mayors because they're living it directly. I mean, I just, you know, when you look at California and they have a $73 billion deficit.
And they're giving out freebies, welfare.
Yes. I mean,
and continuing to allow more people to come in. I mean, it's not like, you know, I don't hear anybody in the California government saying, let's stop, please. Let's do something to control the border.
No, they're not. They're not. I mean, they just say, keep coming, keep coming. It's incredible. They're not even respecting the people of their own state who are going to have to, you know, have some serious tax increases to make up for the $73 billion deficit. So they're not respecting those people.
On the contrary, you've got politicians one of the ladies that's running for Senate that is asking for a $50 an hour wage. $50 an hour. Crazy. Absolute insanity.
Well, I just saw a story today about another business closing. They just can't. I mean, you cannot run a business with a minimum wage like that. That's just crazy. Absolutely crazy. Well, let's move on for a second here, George. So much fun talking to you. The time flies. Well, let's move on. I've got a post coming out Wednesday morning, and it's based on an article that I saw today from our friends at Pulse News Mexico. It's a great website that they have down in Mexico. I'm subscribed to it. It's a free subscription, but I get the notifications. And today's story was absolutely amazing. Mexico right now, the Mexican peso is actually very strong. Now, for those who are not familiar with currency fluctuations, when Mexico has a very strong peso, meaning basically it's more expensive to go to Mexico. If you're a tourist, when the Mexican peso is strong, then that means that a trip to Cancun or the hotel or whatever is more expensive. When it comes down, then it's cheaper. So the idea is to have it at a reasonable point where both sides win. But when Mexico has a peso that is very strong, their exports to the United States will also become expensive. So it's a double-edged sword, really, for Mexico. And I happen to know from personal experience what it was like to go through a devaluation in Mexico. It's a traumatic moment for Mexico. But anyway, looking at the article and going through the article, I find out that one of the reasons that the peso is so strong is because of the $60 billion in remittances, George. $60 billion.
With a B.
With a B, yeah. Not M like Mary, B like Bob. Okay. I mean, we're talking big money, big money. $60 billion is a big amount of money. And this money, of course, you know, we know how it works. It goes through families, but eventually it ends up in the Central Bank of Mexico, of course. And this is what's one of the reasons the peso is holding on so strong. And it just leads me to conclude that this could be a problem for Mexico, not just from the standpoint that Mexico becomes more expensive, George, but because Mexico becomes very vulnerable to the outside. I mean, basically, what if President Trump says, we're going to tax your remittances, for example? What is Mexico going to do?
You know, it's been very, very interesting. It's been very, very interesting to watch Mexico's economy. Now, since you know, college, that I've known what was going on and watching it, Mexico and living in Mexico, Mexico has always attempted to protect itself economically and politically as best it could against the United States and against the world, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, you know, particularly against the United States, protect itself as best it could. However, under AMLO, AMLO doesn't seem to be protecting anybody or anything. And I'm not sure exactly. I mean, he's another Biden with Spanish subtitles, it seems like. They seem to be getting the worst of everything. Not only, you know, crime and the cartels, but there was that other article that you shared with me regarding that they're having a hard time finding farm workers because all of the poor workers, all of the low-skilled workers are moving north of the border. Mm-hmm. And, you know, leaving them, you know, well, who's going to pick their vegetables? Who's going to do that? I mean, they are in a bad shape. They are in bad shape. And I'm not sure. I mean, AMLO just doesn't seem to either he's purposely trying to wreck the nation, or he is so out of touch. It's not even funny.
Well, it's probably a little bit of both, but don't overestimate being out of touch, because I think that he may not realize, you know, just how bad his policies are. But the article about the farm workers is fascinating. They literally do not have enough people to pick up strawberries and whatever it is they pick up, and they export. That's the other thing too.
Yeah.
Exports are a big, agricultural exports are a big part of Mexico, but
well, so many of the things that Mexico does, so much of their employment is low skill. I mean, so much of it is, and you know, something was bound to give if that low skill labor kept moving north.
Right.
And you know,
well, not only in, but this is the pact, you know, the story about signing a pact with the devil, whatever the story is. Because, yes, I mean, they require these workers. But Mexico has also come to love the remittances.
Yes.
So it's a very difficult situation that they're in. So which is more important, the remittances they're sending back, the $60 billion that I just mentioned, or the fact that they can stay home and pick up strawberries because we need them? So what's more important? And I guess they decided to send them north for the remittances, but now they don't have enough workers. And then now you hear that they're talking, this is laughable, or at least it makes me laugh. It's sad, but it makes me laugh. Now they're talking about instituting a guest worker program to bring in people from Central America to pick up their strawberries. And I mean, I say strawberries, there's hundreds of things.
Whatever.
That they need to, yes, well, whatever. But it is fascinating. But in a sense, they made a decision, Trump. I mean, George, they made a decision somewhere along the way. I don't know when, but they made a decision that the remittances were stronger than having the workers at home. And now they're paying for it because now they don't have workers.
I don't know. I mean, to me, it is just so convoluted and ridiculous. Those are the only two words that I can use with this situation with poor Mexico. Convoluted and ridiculous, that it's just, you know, I'm not sure how they can, you know, until they get rid of AMLO and reinstitute some type of national economy that puts Mexico first, they're in bad shape. You know, they're in bad shape. And then, of course, they have to address the whole issue of what the cartels contribute to their economy. I mean, the cartels contribute a lot to their economy.
Well, there are the only figures that I've seen on the drug business, and it's unofficial, of course, there's no official record of this, but I one time I heard that it was around $30 billion.
Yeah.
$30 that comes in because of the drug business. Now that, I don't know about the human trafficking business, that's more recent, but anyway, to me, the scariest thing is that when you're getting remittances of that level, that a president of the United States could actually say, you know what, we're losing too much money here. You guys are sending too much money back home. We're going to put a tax on it. And that could really be damaging.
You know, if that happens, and I think that it probably will, if Trump is elected, I'm not sure if I should use the term reelected, but if Trump wins, and if there is a backlash, you know, like I think there will be regarding the open border, a tax on remittance is something that's very, very real. And if that happens, I mean, it's going to really throw Mexico into a spin.
Well, no, it's going to be very, very devastating. But I will tell you this, I think where you'll see the push for the tax on remittances, it's not so much from the U.S. federal government, because really $60 billion, it's a drop in the ocean mm-hmm. for the American economy. I mean, you barely feel it. But the $60 billion is coming from people in small communities.
Right.
So, for example, if you're a town in Texas, I don't know, let's say Waco, and people who live there are sending probably a few million dollars every year, that is money that is coming out of your community.
Exactly.
And, you know, you might turn around and say, well, look, you know, we're going to put a tax on that because, you know, we got to pay for the roads. We got to pay for the schools.
For all the services you're using.
Yes.
You live in our community and you're using services.
Right. And that's where I think you'll see the move come in, where some communities will say, look, I'm sorry. We love you. We know you work hard. But
so do the rest of us.
Yeah, that's right. And we got to have some. So anyway, I just think it's fascinating. $60 billion is the latest figure. And George, I remember when it was $20 billion. And it's not that long ago.
No, it wasn't.
Wasn't that long ago. I mean,
it's amazing how an open border can open things up so quickly.
Yes, and how the word has gotten around that if you can get to the United States, you can support your family.
Right. Now, again, the remittance could also be impacted by the enforcement of immigration law. If that begins to happen, a lot of these people are going to leave. And that will cut into it as well.
Right. And we don't have any official figures on, you know, who sends the remittances, whether it's legal immigrants who are here, illegal immigrants. We don't know because that kind of information is not available. But my gut feeling, this is just my gut feeling, is that it's probably more likely to be a person who's in the country illegally because he still has a connection back home. He's got somebody to support back home.
Right.
That's my gut feeling from talking to people, but it's not an official information. Let me get to a couple of other topics here before our time flies. Number one, there's a lot of talk about a VP choice for Donald Trump. And it's going to be a tough call. I don't expect them to make it. I think it'll go another month or so before he makes it, probably closer to June 1st. I believe my choice of the week, or flavor of the week, if I could put it that way, And to be honest with you, George, it's been my flavor of the last 2 weeks. So I'm going to say my flavor for the last 2 weeks is Senator Rubio. Now, why Senator Rubio? Not because he's Hispanic. That doesn't hurt, but that's not really why. But because he's one of the most serious foreign policy senators, extremely telegenic. And I think that he would do very well explaining the Trump policies and also standing in a debate. So I'm my choice of the week for the last 2 weeks, George, Senator Rubio. What's your choice of the week, George?
Mine, well, for the week, I guess it's going to be Kristi Noem, the governor. And again, the
of South Dakota, right?
Yeah. South Dakota. And I think she handles herself beautifully. I think she's very 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 photogenic, and she would help the ticket with the abortion issue. She is a woman, you know, unlike others that we see around right now that are not in the Biden administration. She is a woman, and I think she could speak to the issue of abortion very very well.
Okay, and of course, the issue of abortion has changed here dramatically in the last 24 hours because President Trump, as you know, came out and said that he supported whatever the states...
Exactly.
Which is what I support.
Which is, yeah, I think all of us do.
Yeah, that's where I'm at. Yeah. I never supported a national ban. Yeah. I know Lindsey Graham wanted to do that, but I have always said, hey, this is a state issue and let the states... Now, I will say this. I do believe it makes sense, but it should be decided state by state, not by the federal government.
Yeah, exactly.
But I think that a exception for rape and incest, I'm willing to live with that. Mm-hmm. Because I think, you know, in some cases, that's just okay. Just giving
as long people, as you have a DA that enforces it.
Well, that's true. But anyway, so what I think is where I agree, but if you leave it to the states, I think that's the best way to go. Yeah. Let every state figure it out.
That is the Constitution.
That is the Constitution. And but I think why when President Trump did today, though, or yesterday, is that he took a big issue away from the Democrats because they were going to run against a national ban. And that ain't going to happen.
Yep. I'm now, not sure what they can run on right now. I am not sure what they can run on other than January 6th.
January 6th and Trump is a dictator.
Yeah, that's it.
Trump's going to be a dictator. So Trump's going to be a dictator, but Joe Biden is going to go around the Supreme Court to give away money to college students. So I need to figure that out. All right, one last question or one last topic, a quick one here. The latest RCP average has Senator Cruz plus 7 against Congressman Allred. I think that's a pretty fair number. I actually think that's how it's going to end up, about plus 7. How do you see it, George? What are you hearing?
I think so too. Here in South Texas, the Democrats are stumbling all over themselves as to how to portray their party as being strong against Ted Cruz and his racism and anti-immigrant, while at the same time trying to portray themselves as being for border security. They're not able to do that. It is an absolute disaster that that the Democrats have in their backyard with everything from school choice to the gun ban. I mean, everything. Now they've got a candidate who wants to run towards the middle and activists that don't want him to run towards the middle. So good luck with that.
You know, that's a big story. I'm glad you mentioned that because that's the problem Allred is going to have.
Uh-huh.
That the more he tries to be from the middle, the more he loses the people who are really running the party. So that's a good point.
Volunteers.
Yeah. He's not going to have the same amount of money that Cruz had.
No.
I mean, that O'Rourke had back in 2018. He's not going to have any money like that. So that's the other.
Yeah, he's not as well known, not as popular as O'Rourke, and so therefore he's got to push his own agenda, and you know his agenda is just so tied up with the left.
Right.
That
good point. That's a good point. You know. Well, the one thing that I will say, there is another wild card to this race, and that is how President Trump will do in Texas.
Yes.
The latest, again, RCP average, for whatever that's worth, I tend to follow that one because it takes all the polls and creates an average so that you're not relying on one poll. But the latest one has Trump close to 10 points. Mm-hmm. So if Trump can be around 10 or 11 points, that's going to help.
I'm not sure up in Dallas or North Texas, but here in South Texas, we are increasingly seeing again a phenomenon that we saw 4 years ago, which is Trump trains, which is weekends, on weekends, people organizing. They're mobile rallies. People will get on trucks, will decorate their trucks and cars with Trump messages and literally run up and down the road back and forth through communities. And it really, I mean, you're seeing that in predominantly Hispanic communities. So again, what message the Democrats have other than being victims, I'm not sure.
Yeah, and I think that after a while, calling a guy with the last name of Cruz, who is the son of an immigrant, calling him racist and immigrant, you know, after a while, that gets a little...
He's old. A racist and an immigrant.
Yeah, I mean, the son of an immigrant, okay, is now a racist and an immigrant. I mean, after a while, they themselves have to be looking at that and wondering what
they're doing. They've painted themselves into a corner. They have.
They have. They have to be sitting there saying, come on, can't we do better than this?
Yeah, I mean...
I would think.
It's laughable.
It is laughable because they have no substance. Everything, you're a racist, you're a white supremacist, or Trump is going to be a dictator. Well, here's the problem, George, that I always tell people. Trump was already president. And I don't remember anybody getting thrown in jail because they disagreed with Trump. I don't remember Trump closing any networks. I don't remember closing any newspapers. I don't remember shutting down anybody because they disagreed with him. So how can you call the guy a dictator? Look, people like me, and I was a young boy when I left Cuba, but I know what a dictator is.
You've seen it.
I've seen it. And my parents not only saw it, but they lived it. So when somebody talks to me about somebody being a dictator, my point of reference immediately is Castro.
The real one.
Yeah, the real one. I say, okay, well, how does he compare with Castro? And I'm telling you, there's no comparison. So they need to change their, if this was a baseball game, the curve is not breaking, George. Their curveball is just not breaking. Well, George, as always, it is an absolute honor and pleasure to have you.
Thank you.
And we got to do it again. And maybe the next time we'll have SBA 4 to talk about.
Hopefully.
Thank you. You have a great day, my friend.
Thank you. You too.
All right. Our good friend, George Rodriguez from South Texas, always check up with him once a week or so to see what's happening in Texas politics. But yes, I'm going to say it again. When people tell me that Trump is going to be a dictator, you know, I, as my mother used to say, we saw that movie before. My mother, of course, and father came here from Cuba. They brought me when I was 12. So they saw what a dictatorship was. They felt it. They lived it. So when anybody talks to me about somebody being a dictator, my point of reference is Castro. And I didn't see anything that Trump did that even resembles or comes 100 miles close to what a guy like Castro did. So anyway, thank you for listening. Thank you for watching today. Everybody have a wonderful day. And this is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, saying thank you and so long. Bye-bye, everybody.